of you who don't know me. Just to let you know that this meeting will be recorded, so you're being asked now whether you consent to that. You can still change your name if you don't want to appear, and the Q&A session will not be recorded. I'm very happy to welcome you to this third installment of our History of Formal Semantics interviews. Our distinguished interviewee today is Martin Stokov, and our interviewer is Louise Magnali. So over to you both.
Okay, so let me begin by thanking the organizers again for everything they've been doing and also for this opportunity, which was really a great pleasure for me, so to be able to interview Martin. I'll begin by introducing Martin, even though I'm sure his name is well known to all of you as is much of his work, but Martin is a multifaceted person, and so there are some things to say. So he is currently professor of philosophy of language at the University of Amsterdam, I think part-time now, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, actually, retired, but
not entirely from what I can tell. Yeah. And also he spends, since 2017, part of the year at the Tsinghua University in Beijing as the Qin Yue Len, I hope I said that correctly, professor of philosophy. And I had to look up who this philosopher was. He was one of the early analytic philosophers in China and very prominent. So I'm guessing that most of the people in the audience mainly work in natural language semantics. And so you will know Martin, especially for his work on the semantics of questions, which he did with Jeroen Grunendijk, and also for his work in dynamic predicate logic and dynamic Montague grammar. We heard a little bit about that, especially on the first day. But actually, Martin has done a lot more than that. So his earliest papers actually were really about the semantics-pragmatics interface. So modality, implicature, performatives, also the interpretation of pronouns. And he came back to these works later in the dynamic setting, especially in collaboration with Grunendijk and Frank Veltman. But then in the late 1990s, Martin became a Wittgenstein scholar, and he has written since then quite a lot on Wittgenstein's work. We will not get into that in this interview because that's a bit later, but I do think it has influenced another area that we will get into and that Martin has been very concerned which is foundations of the theory of meaning. So foundations of semantic theory. So Martin, if you know him, you will know he is an extremely modest and discreet person. And so I will not embarrass him by listing all of the other things that he has done. And all of the honors he's received, but I will mention two things that I think are very important. So first, he has done an enormous amount of editorial work. I was actually amazed. So if I saw correctly, 20 years practically as an associate editor of linguistics and philosophy, which is mind-blowing if you have been an editor to last that long. Angelica will know because she's been with natural language semantics, but I think there are not too many people who have been so long in an editorial position. And when he left linguistics and philosophy, more or less, shortly thereafter, he got involved with the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. And so, and he's been there for another 15 years as the logic and language editor. So this, in addition to being an important contribution just to the field as a whole, I think, has given him a very broad picture of what the field is like and especially connections of linguistics to philosophy and logic. In addition, Martin's story is very much connected to the story of formal semantics in the Netherlands. So the last 2 days we had sort of more the North American continent. Today we're going to get sort of a different vision, which is the beginning of the European vision. And a little bit later in time, because Martin comes into the picture a bit later. And so being so bound up with semantics in the Netherlands, it may not surprise you that he is a mereological part of LTF Gamut, the authors of the two-volume Introduction to Logic, Language, and Information, which he did with Johann von Bentham, Jeroen Groenendijk, Dick de Jong, and Henk Verkouw. So that is the introduction. And let me welcome Martin.
Thank you.
So now it's time for you to start. So as I said, you came into the scene a bit later than Hans and Barbara. You began your studies at the University of Amsterdam in 1969. And actually, Barbara has written a very nice sort of history of what she called the title is something like the Amsterdam Three. And she talks about you and Frank Veltman and Jeroen Groenendijk. So I will try not to repeat the things that Barbara has already said. But she says, but to just get things started, you began doing both philosophy and linguistics. So tell us a bit what that was like and how you got into formal semantics.
Yeah, okay. But may I also begin by thanking the organizers for the very honorable invitation. I really appreciate it. And thank you, Louise, for agreeing to be my interviewer. So. I started studying both philosophy out of interest and Dutch language and literature in order to secure myself as a future job as a teacher in a high school. But that sort of came to an end, but not the philosophy part, but the Dutch language and literature after a year or so. Partly because that particular academic program was heavily influenced by the democracy movement. So everything had to be done in working groups, which then gave themselves grades and stuff like that. Which made it also practically impossible for us, because we did this together, Jeroen Groenendijk and I, to combine the two curricula. And also we got some people in the philosophy department who said, well, have you ever thought about pursuing an academic career? I never had thought about that, but it seemed sort of attractive at the time, and later on also. So we switched from, we kept the philosophy going, and we switched from Dutch to general linguistics. And general linguistics, mainly also because we were very much attracted by the ideas of Chomsky, transformational grammar, but also a budding interest in semantics that came from our early exposure to logic and analytical philosophy in the philosophy department. Combine those two for another 4 years, and then graduated finally in philosophy. We never came round to doing the last requirements for the linguistics degree, but by then we were employed on a project, and we sort of dropped that. But basically it was both philosophy and linguistics in a very broad sense. The philosophy was mainly logic and analytical philosophy and philosophy of science, although there were compulsory courses in history, philosophy, ethics, and so on and so forth. And general linguistics was very open. Simon Dick was the new, I think he was appointed professor only 2 or 3 years before we started studying with him. And he had ran a very open department. Henk van Riemsdijk was there as a real generativist, but also people like Novel Smith and Winter Ford, psycholinguistics, phonology. Simon himself was very open-minded, very broadly interested in all sorts of aspects of linguistics and philosophy. And at the time, there was a vacancy in the philosophy department for the philosophy of language chair. So that had been become vacant because Fritz Stahl went off to Berkeley after a big row with the aesthetics professor in Amsterdam. And then there was a replacement for him, a new professor, but that was a German professor who used his appointment in Amsterdam to negotiate his a better position at his home university. So he never showed up. And that was at the time when we were doing our graduate work. So Simon volunteered to oversee our studies in philosophy or language, which we sort of, that was sort of a joint program that we drew up with lots of reading stuff in analytical philosophy, but also in stuff that was becoming more and more prominent in linguistics. Davidson, we read, for example, Creswell's Logic on Language. We did algebraic linguistics, but also something that I remember very clearly, we did a big typology project on pronominal systems where we studied a wide range of languages with a small group of people, five or six, just making inventories of how various pronominal systems in various language families were realized. So I learned a lot about the very complex demonstrative reference that you have in Austronesian languages, where you have separate expressions for this one over there in front of the hill and this one over there on the other side of the hill. Mm-hmm. Sort of grammatically distinct phrases. So that was all very, very fruitful, very informative, and left us with a very broad view of what linguistics was all about. But for us, the main emphasis was on formal semantics, which was beginning to appear. Mm-hmm. So I remember that in philosophy, we Johan van Bentham was just appointed assistant professor, I think in 72 or 73. And he was doing this very technical stuff in modal logic. So we took his class and we sort of did the first semester, and then the second semester was, well, either more of the very technical stuff or something else. And since Jeroen and I were, I think, 2/3 of the student population in that course, we forced him, Johan, to read instead Montague's papers. Sure. With us. So we had him, we go to PTQ and Universal Grammar and studied the technical details of that. So that was basically sort of how we got into philosophy and linguistics.
Mm-hmm. So I was very curious to hear the story that Barbara told, and she brought it up the other day about how Simon Dick took you to this Keenan conference, in the one that she mentioned, and this was, Barbara describes it as a chance for you and Jeroen to help interview Renata Bartsch. So yeah. What was that experience like from the student perspective?
That must be very odd to hear for and people from a younger generation, but at the time when the university in Amsterdam was fully democratized, so there was a search committee for a new professor in philosophy of language, and Jeroen and I were student members. Simon was he was not in the philosophy department, but he was an outside member. And there was a professor of metaphysics who was also a member of the committee, and maybe one other person that I can't recall. But actually, basically, we, together with Simon, were the people who had most knowledge of the field. And we definitely wanted someone who could do formal semantics, because we thought that was very exciting. We wanted to know more about it and work in that area. We had a bunch of applicants, and a number of them actually were performing or giving lectures at the Keenan conference. So we sort of persuaded the department's administration to pay our travels to Cambridge with the excuse that we could actually see these people and give lectures and bring that information back to the committee for to base a decision on. And we did have a lengthy talk with Renate during a reception in King's College, if I recall correctly. Now, well, nowadays that's sort of almost impossible to imagine a procedure for appointing a full professor be conducted like that, but that was so the upside of the democracy movement, I would say.
And so once she arrived, then did the kind of program start to get a bit more structured? Although I guess at that point you guys must have been pretty much finished your courses. So
yeah, we were already finished with our coursework. We were actually had already written our thesis more or less. So Renate arrived in the fall of 1974, and we got our degrees in September. So she did preside over the defense, but we basically wrote the thesis under supervision of Simon and Johan.
But was that your doctoral thesis? Because your doctoral thesis is actually from much later. So,
yeah.
But
no,
so
that was our MA thesis. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's the on the epistemic reading of morals. Our doctoral thesis is we defended that 10 years later because at the time doing a PhD was something unusual in philosophy, in Dutch philosophy. So there were quite a number of associate professors who didn't have a doctoral degree. There were even at the time a couple of full professors who didn't have a doctoral degree. Right? So because, yeah, that was something, a dissertation was something that was sort of the completion of a life's work. So you did that after, I don't know, 20 or 30 years or so. Yeah. A completely different mindset from what it is today. So we started working on a project that was supervised by Teun van Dijk, who was at the time a professor in text linguistics in Amsterdam. And it was the title was Performative and Pragmatics, so it was supposed to be about performatives and pragmatics. And we worked on various issues in that area for a couple of years, and we almost finished the dissertation on epistemic pragmatics. So there are a couple of papers with applications of that framework on specificity and one on the Conway paradox. But at some point we couldn't agree about the application of the framework in the analysis of belief ascriptions. So that sort of grinded to a halt.
You didn't agree with each other, or you didn't agree with Teun?
No, we didn't agree with each other. So that's the downside of a very close cooperation, is that, if one of the guys, that happened actually quite a lot. So one of us sort of didn't see something, and then the other said, well, let's try this. And then, so you sort of can talk each other out of a quagmire. But if you're both down in the pits, then it's very difficult to get out. So that's a dissertation that never saw the light of day. It's still resting somewhere in a closet, locked away. But as a matter of fact, Simon Dick at some point asked us a question, but how do you do questions? And we thought that was an interesting challenge. So we started looking into what was around. What was around was, of course, primarily Lauri Kartunen's analysis for questions. So we studied that, and we disagreed with some features of his analysis, so developed our own. And that sort of proved to be quite a rich source of various problems and ways of developing the material further. So we wrote a couple of papers on that, and at some point we were allowed to defend that as our thesis. But then, by then, 10 years had passed.
And so were you already at the time that you were developing the thesis, since you were working on pragmatics, were you already beginning to think about issues related to discourse dynamics or to partial information or these kind of things, or did that come along?
Not really, although that came really later, but there actually, thinking about this interview, I somehow remembered that we had an early paper on infinitives and context, which we presented at the an Albany conference, which I think was in 1976. But Barbara was there. It's the first time we met her. Was it 76? Mm-hmm. I think she's nodding. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in that paper there, we had a sort of a mechanism for switching denotations in the course of interpreting a sentence. So there was some kind of dynamics going on there. Yeah. And there was a similar sort of mechanism in an analysis of demonstratives, mm-hmm. demonstrative use of pronouns, that's somewhere buried in another paper. So thinking about context as something that has an inherently dynamic dimension, mm-hmm. the germs of that were already there, but realizing what it was all about came only after we were exposed to Hans's work on DRT.
So that leads to my next question, which is when did you meet Hans? Because Hans, from what I understand, was passing through or spent some time in Amsterdam, but not really an extended time either. And so I'm kind of curious to connect the timeline, since we didn't really get so far in Hans's story.
Yeah. Well, the first time I met Hans was in December of 1976, when he appeared as a visitor at the first installment of the Amsterdam Colloquium. And he was there, I think, mainly because Frank Veldman, who was at the time located in Rotterdam, was giving a paper there. And Hans was his supervisor. I think I got that right. I think Hans is nodding.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So Hans...
Well, I don't know, but that's how I remember it. So Hans was at the time located in Bedford, at Bedford College in London. Mm-hmm. So we got to know him through Frank Veldman. Of course, we heard about him and we knew his work about now and of course, and we knew that he had a connection with Amsterdam because of via Dick de Jong, who was by that at the time already a couple of years back in Amsterdam. So we knew about the sort of the backstory, but hadn't met him until 76.
So since you also brought up the Amsterdam Colloquium, this is something that I also wanted to bring up. I was amazed. So for those of you who don't know the full history of the Amsterdam Colloquium, the first one was held in 1976, as Martin just said, and it's been held every 2 years since then, except I noticed that between 1984 and 1987, for some reason, there was like a bit more than a 2 year gap. Yeah. But an amazing fact is that, Martin, you were involved in the organization of the first 14 Amsterdam colloquia. Like, I have checked this. And so the editor of the proceedings, at some point, you left the local organization and became one of the internal committee members. But on one of them, I think this was after Fred Lantman got involved. So just this is an aside for those of you who were not at the SALT kind of history of semantics this year, Fred Lantman was there and he made the comment that he was one of the people to introduce reviewing into the Amsterdam Colloquium. Initially, it was just invited speakers, and he didn't really describe how the reviewing went, but on the web of one of the colloquia, I don't know, from the late 90s or something, it says, all we received 106 abstracts, and all 106 abstracts were reviewed by the internal committee members. So it just sounded like a gargantuan amount of work. So tell us a bit about the colloquium.
That was so Renate came in 1974, and she really brought with her a whole network of connections with people working in formal semantics. So she, there were the German connections with Arnim von Stechow and Helmut Schnelle and lots of other people there, but also with people in the US, like Kaplan, Searle. Searle wasn't, of course, in formal semantics, but because of the time she spent at Harvard and later at UCLA, where I think she didn't overlap with Barbara. Year.
I think, yeah.
For us, who were basically sort of coming from this, from sort of from a local perspective, getting access to Renate's network was of course amazing to. An amazing experience, and she always was very emphatic about letting us do our own thing. So she she never made herself prominent, or she was always very much sort of stimulating us to do various things. So at some point we had this regular colloquium, which weekly, which attracted also people increasingly from the rest of the Netherlands, Nijmegen, Groningen, Eindhoven, and also from Germany and France and Belgium and England. And at some point we thought, well, maybe we should have an international conference. So that was the first Amsterdam colloquium. That was the first, and the second were mainly with people from Europe, both continental and the UK, and from 1980 onwards, it was it opened up to the world, so to speak. That was the first time that Barbara was there. Hans was also there, was at the time in the US, and then it grew into what it is today. But that was very exciting to get to know these people whose stuff you have read, and then to present your own ideas. I remember that we had a sort of a short seminar introducing people to Montagu grammar as an introduction for the first conference, which was done by Jeroen, by me, Theo Jansen, and Alistair Merlin was a graduate student still then. It was before she left for Stanford. And I remember that Peter Suren was also there. And he started, for those of you who know Peter Suren, you know that he can always ask very obnoxious questions in a very polite way. And he started throwing donkey sentences at us and said, but this was after we had introduced the quantification rules of PTQ. Yeah, but how do you do that? And of course, none of us knew how to do that. So we started to wriggle our way around and said, there must be. It's only later that I realized that Peter had gotten those examples from Geech while he was still in Cambridge and had more of close interactions with Geech. So we came back to donkey sentences only 15 years later, but they came back to bite us.
Okay. Let's see. How are we doing with time? Oh, we have lots of time. So one other thing that I was sort of curious about was how how the network also grew a lot in the Netherlands. I mean, I remember when I was a student that, Netherlands and semantics was like almost coextensive somehow. The community was very active. So I see Rob here too. So were you in addition to the Amsterdam Colloquium, what other sorts of connections did you have? I mean, people did not really have the same facility to, I don't know, talk on the internet and so forth, or maybe not quite so much as now. So were you meeting regularly, or, and how how were the topics also evolving, would you say?
Well, the basic vehicle for interaction was the working group on Montes grammar and related topics. Mm-hmm. That was its full title, which met, I think, in its heydays every 14 days or every 2 weeks, where people came to present their stuff. And I know that what was interesting is that it was a very open, very critical but very productive kind of environment. Mm-hmm. So I know that some people later told me that they sort of came to Amsterdam to present their stuff with some trepidation, because, especially for those of you who have known Theo Jansen, he was a very outspoken critic, but always very fair. So the discussions were, nobody spared anybody if something was wrong, or you've forgotten a lambda or a cap or a cup operator didn't match them. You were told, but it always in a very constructive atmosphere. So that was that's how we sort of forged these connections with people, and so they started coming back. And another important sort of element in the growth of semantics was that we that exported Johan van Bentum to Groningen for a while. Mm-hmm. So he was appointed full professor there at some point, and started growing his own environment there with Jan van Eyck. Mm-hmm. Frans Schwartz was there, and Jack Hoeksema, Alice was there for a while after she came back from the US. Mm-hmm. So that was a very vibrant community. Mm-hmm. And there were people in Nijmegen, Rob, later Bart, of course. Mm-hmm. Peter sort of kept a distance from the hardcore formal semantics, but he mm-hmm. was very knowledgeable and in a sense also supportive of it. There were people in Eindhoven. So Eindhoven, at the time, Philips Lab had a computer science department, sort of research department, where people like Remco Scha and Harry Bund worked and applied techniques from formal semantics in the development of question answering systems. So yeah, that sort of was quite a closely knit community.
So one thing that I remember very much about it, so when I was a PhD student, which was a little bit later, let's say, so in the late 80s, was, so you would get these grass volumes, the mm-hmm. sort of proceedings, they were sort of the proceedings of the Amsterdam Colloquium, or I remember getting like Fred Lantman's dissertation, and it seemed like it was a constant, there was an enormous amount of variety in actually the kind of formal stuff people were doing. And so now maybe to sort of move into a little bit the second question that we were asked by the organizers to bring up. So things that are related to developments in the field. One thing that I found kind of striking was, and I always associated with Amsterdam, whether, I don't know, just with a solid basis or not, was just a tremendous amount of like heterogeneity in the kind of specific tools people would use. So where did that come from?
I think that's part of the answer is probably that people who were involved in that community had very heterogeneous backgrounds. Mm-hmm. So Jeroen and I studied both philosophy and linguistics. Johann was a logician. Frank Feldman was a logician and a philosopher. But there were Theo Janssen was a mathematician and computer scientist. Mm-hmm. There were other Peter van Emden Boas was a computer scientist, mm-hmm. and was very much interested also in formal semantics. Very so there were Frans Schwarz was a linguist. Jack Hoeksma was a linguist. Jan van Eyck was a philosopher. Mm-hmm. So I think it's this the variety in backgrounds also explains the differences in perspectives and formal tools that you bring to mm-hmm. sort of the common interests of, well, semantics of natural language. So yeah, I think that's part of the explanation, that people were constantly exposing each other to different techniques, different formal concepts.
Well, but also one thing that I think is a bit unusual about Amsterdam is, at least from what I know about it, just from having visited the ILLC and gotten to know the university as a whole, is that actually the Linguistics Institute as such in Amsterdam is really a separate unit. And so I'm wondering if the differences, if I can sort of dare to say this, like towards somewhat greater uniformity in the US in the way semantics, the way semanticists talk to each other, the tools they use and so forth, versus maybe Amsterdam is related to that fact that maybe in the end linguistics sort of separated a bit from, obviously there are lots of linguists associated with the ILLC, but that you have this other sort of background that's heavily influenced by logic, philosophy.
I think that's true. And I think it's funny that you mentioned this as something that explains the sort of the nature of formal semantics in Amsterdam. Because so the general linguistics department, at some point, Simon Dick started to develop his framework of functional grammar. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of not that congenial with the kind of things that were the other people were doing. So the atmosphere, and we definitely remained on very friendly terms, mm-hmm. But sort of, real interactions and shared interests became less and less. Mm-hmm. And also, I think that it's fair to say that my own perspective, and I think that also goes for Jeroen, was more that of philosophy and logic in the end than of linguist. I would never call myself a linguist. Mm-hmm. So I did study the subject, almost got my degree in it, but no, I wouldn't dare to do that. And that has to do with a certain perspective on the material. We did worry about that for a while, because our exposure to linguists and linguistic concerns was never local, but always via interactions with people like Barbara and others, with people in Groningen, but never with our local, or Henk Verkuil, who was mm-hmm. by the time already in Utrecht, mm-hmm. But never with our local friends in the linguistics department, because the sort of the conceptual perspectives were too different, mm-hmm. and people critically remarked on that. So we did try a number of times to set up colloquia. I know that Maria Aloni, for example, ran a joint working group with people in the linguistics department in the early 2000s, mm-hmm. for a number of years on typological semantics. So there were definitely attempts and willingness, but it never got to this close knit connection that you have elsewhere, mm-hmm. which, mm-hmm. yeah, has its advantages, but also its disadvantages.
Well,
it made our work less linguistically relevant, mm-hmm. in a sense.
Well, one thing that I think has happened is that has continued to influence the way semantics is done in Amsterdam. So I think it's fair to say now there are more linguists or people with linguistic training connected to the ILLC than maybe there was 15 years ago. But from what I've seen there, there's also like continues to be a tremendous variety of stuff that people do, especially moving towards computation. And so I think it's a kind of unusual atmosphere, even if you compare it to, you know, Utrecht or to Germany.
Hmm. Yeah, that's true. And that's sometimes these things are also sort of due to, I don't know, decisions made by the administration. So, for example, computational linguistics, that sort of existed in a very embryonic form in the Faculty of Humanities, when philosophy was still a separate faculty. And then at some point they appointed Remco Schaal, yeah. and Henk Zevat also was appointed in the computational linguistics department. But for some reason or other, Remco failed to have a real sort of intensive relationship with the linguists. Mm-hmm. And so at some point they simply sort of outsourced the computational linguistics to the ILLC. So the people who are doing computational linguistics now, mm-hmm. like Rens, and, Khalil, Siman, mm-hmm. They're in the science faculty, not in the right. humanities faculty. Why that is and whether that could have been otherwise, I can say something about that, but that's not relevant for people to know about the intricacies of the Amsterdam administration.
Okay, I would like to, another question I guess I have on the list of questions is topics, developments that you have considered particularly interesting or relevant, thinking back either to the early part of your experience or as you have moved on in
I knew that this question was coming and I've been thinking about it. I think it for me personally, I think it's so that my great luck in life, academically speaking, is that I came to this sort of newly developing field, where at the time you had a feeling that you knew everybody who worked in it, that you knew all the latest results before they were published. And there was an extreme notion of excitement and adventure. And I cherish those memories of those days where mm-hmm. basically any day there was something new that you could sort of think about and criticize or do something with. Mm-hmm. But I still think that is sort of characteristic for the field as such. Mm-hmm. Also that it is, in my experience, extremely constructive. It's a very constructive community. People are critical. You can't sell them any bullshit, but they're always constructive. Right? They're sort of bound by a common desire to learn and to develop. Mm-hmm. And I found that I've been exposed to other academic communities where I can tell you in my experience that is absolutely not the case. So as far as I can see, that is still the case. But for me, so in the late 90s, when Jeroen and I and Frank had done a lot of work in dynamic semantics, applying it in various to various puzzles, I sort of got bored with it, which sort of seems like a contradiction with what I just said, but it's still that's what it was. I thought, okay, well, I can write more papers about dynamic semantics and X for another 10, 15, 20 years, or something else will come along. But I thought it was better for me, my own development, to make a switch and to start doing some other work. But of course, I came back to it, but then from a different perspective. So at some point, I started asking myself questions like, what kind of a science is linguistics anyway? What are linguistic data? What are linguistic hypotheses? How do you confirm or disconfirm them? And those questions were then sort of more interesting to me than the development of new formalisms or the application of formalisms to new phenomena. Mm-hmm. I mean,
This actually brings me to another question and sort of into the last topic, which is the topic of the connection to philosophy. And I want to come back to Montague and to the things that Hans and Barbara were describing about their experience, and especially something that I hadn't entirely appreciated, which is, so the, on the one hand, Hans said, well, Montague just was interested in developing and applying intentional logic to problems of philosophy. And I found it kind of mind-blowing that he had even contemplated the idea that set theory could have been, you know, everything that you needed to do philosophy. But I guess I also had not really appreciated how much the universal grammar thesis that he had was really mappable in a way onto especially Chomskyan way of thinking about syntax. And so I wanted to take the opportunity to talk a bit about, you know, this way you can look at Montague grammar on the one hand as Montague did, which is as a theory about what let's say the syntax semantics interface of human language is like, which was the thesis of universal grammar, versus as a methodology, as a tool for modeling, which could be one among many tools that you can consider. And so I'd like you to, you know, elaborate on that a little bit in relation to just your experiences in philosophy after, you know, you started especially to look at Wittgenstein.
I think when Hans mentioned that for Montague the paper on the nature of certain philosophical entities was probably closer to what he was really interested in than PDQ, I realized that only much later. I think I read the paper I don't know, early on, but sort of failed to see the importance of it. It was only when I started sort of coming back, and I was actually writing a paper on Wittgenstein's Tractatus in connection with formal semantics, that I realized how much of a deep philosophical hypothesis there is in Montague's universal grammar, right? And so what Barbara said about, well, he failed to see any interest in the notion of universal grammar of Chomsky. He thought that was parochial. But of course, from a linguistic perspective, that's sort of incomprehensible. But from a philosophical perspective, it perfectly is, because you want to know what language is. If you want to know what language and what the essence of language is, then you're not necessarily interested in what characterizes a given set of empirical objects like natural languages. Right? Now, of course, I mean, we can fight to the death about what is an important question and what is not. And I think all these questions are important, but it's equally important to realize that they're really different questions. Mm-hmm. And I think that for me, so at some point I was teaching classes on Wittgenstein, and I know that Dick de Jong once sat in one of those classes, was on Wittgenstein's philosophical investigations. And he asked me whether I didn't feel sort of having a split personality, doing formal semantics as my research field, and teaching on this apparently completely different philosophical ideas that the later Wittgenstein developed. And I realized that for me there was no conflict between them. They were of course different, but apparently without my knowing it myself or my realizing that, my interest in formal semantics was more of the Montagovian than of the linguistic nature. I thought it was interesting because it taught me something about the notion of language in a very essential sense of the word. And that is something that you find in early Wittgenstein's work, in a sense also in later Wittgenstein's work, although of course the notion of essence there is something that you shouldn't be mentioning, but still it's trying to grasp the very nature of something over and beyond its empirical manifestations.
Well,
I don't know whether that answers your question.
I'm kind of surprised because it seemed to me, and this is also something that I think echoes with something that I've heard you say in a talk. You know, if you take Montague's thesis seriously, you are also in a sense, and if you say, well, okay, I make do with intentional logic, right, that's my hypothesis, you are committed to saying in a sense that some things are part of language and other things are not necessarily a part of language. And there, well, I don't know, maybe you disagree with that, but.
Of course. So when I side with Montague, it's not, I don't side with his answer, but I side with the question that he's asking, that he's interested. Mm-hmm. At least, this is of course, with lots of hindsight, and maybe not correct, but so I do think that language can be characterized by the kind of abstract formal structures that Montague thought it could be characterized with. For me, language is such a heterogeneous phenomenon that I doubt whether there can be such a thing as a theory of language. I think that it's way too complicated, it's way too diverse, it's way too connected with all sorts of aspects of human existence to defy an attempt to capture it in one theory, certainly not in a theory of that kind. That being said, I think trying to asking that question and trying to answer it is a philosophical enterprise rather than a linguistic or an empirical kind of question. And in that sense, I would agree with Montague.
And maybe a slightly different question, and I think this will be almost the last question because we're getting close to the end of the time. What one thing that I have personally found striking as I have gone back sometimes to philosophical literature that is, you know, maybe philosophy of language, but not so closely tied to formal semantics, is in a sense a much greater diversity in terms of hypotheses that people actually entertain about what human language is like. So, you know, conceptualism, so thinking that language is really a relation between words and things in people's minds is something that you find in philosophers who are in other respects very closely connected to Chomsky and linguistics, like maybe Paul Piotrowski would be an example of that. And so I'm also curious to get a sense of how you see the fit between especially philosophy of language and the methods people use in it versus what people are doing in formal semantics, and maybe how that has changed over time. I mean, there was a time when I saw, I sort of have the sense that the paths have crossed in some ways and gotten closer, but in other sense, or in other places have maybe diverged more.
Yeah. That's a tough one. I don't know. I can see the conversions in some cases, like Piotrowski that you mentioned. Also people who are developing views like expressivism and people working on semantics of predicates of personal taste. I mean, there you have sort of interesting connections. I'm not that optimistic, if I may be so bold to say that, about current philosophy of language, because I think it tends to get bogged down in very subtle. I mean, and there's the intellectual quality of the work is beyond doubt. But I think it's sort of, you know, it's becoming more and more scholastic, right? You make distinctions, and within that distinction, you make another two distinctions, and then you label them, and then you got variant A of label one and variant, and so on and so forth, where I think people tend to lose track of why they're doing this in the first place, which is to understand something that is admittedly very complex, but not in that sense of that of those very subtle conceptual distinctions. So I think getting back to discussions about what are robust data for linguists and philosophers of language to worry about. Mm-hmm. How do you access them? What does it mean that people don't agree when they are asked to judge whether something follows from something else, or whether something is ambiguous, or what it means in a particular context? Right? The fact that you get different answers there says something, and something that also should inform the way in which we develop adequate descriptions and explanatory theories. Mm-hmm. And I think that current philosophy of languages is moving away from that rather than taking that on board. And that's because the amount of specialization in these disciplines is becoming mind-boggling. Mm-hmm. I mean, and this goes back to something that I mentioned earlier. When I entered the field, I thought, maybe I must have been wrong, but I thought I knew everybody after a couple of years, basically. Nowadays, everybody that you know is, and you know a lot of people, is still just a very tiny specialized community of a larger community of something that is a sub-discipline of a discipline. And I don't know how to break that sort of to turn that around, because this is connected to the way in which academia is organized, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that, I mean, I did 10 years for getting my PhD. Nowadays, you would be laughed out of your department within 3 years if you operated like that. Mm-hmm. The demands that people, young PhDs, early career stage researchers have to fulfill, we're forcing them down that road. So mm-hmm. In a sense, we can't, I don't blame them, because this is how academia is structured. Mm-hmm. And we need to find ways to turn that around. So we can't mm-hmm. just say to people, you shouldn't be doing that, because that's the way we organize the whole thing, with grants and postdocs and temporary mm-hmm. positions and so on and so forth. We're forcing people to specialize. And I think that's, in the end, that's not a productive development, both in terms of the outcomes of our increased understanding of what we want to understand, but also not in social and psychological terms. I mean, it's putting pressure on people that is actually downright really unfair.
Well, definitely. I mean, here the many, many issues come up, and I think there will be if it hasn't happened already, there's a hangout somehow on this topic of professional development, right, Louisa? Or has that already happened?
Is that Magda's?
Yeah. So this was the other day.
That was yesterday, yeah. Ah.
It would be interesting to know what came up in that.
In
the context of that. Sorry. Yeah, yeah. So it's 5:00, so maybe we should move to the question and answer portion of this session. But let me first thank you very much, Martin, for sharing your experiences with us and your perspective. And
it's my pleasure, as the Chinese would say.
And there's already a question. So.